It's very good to be with you all today. It's been good to be with you for the weekend. I always enjoy coming up. I always enjoy the hospitality. I always enjoy seeing it done right by the brethren here at Vandalia, and it's an inspiration every time. I really do appreciate it. It's customary for me whenever I'm asked to speak somewhere other than the home congregation to pilot the subject content with a discussion on Sunday night previous to my offering for a variety of reasons. One's to scrub some soft thinking on my part, and more heads are better than one, where oftentimes you wind up getting better ideas maybe to share than what you would have originally otherwise. And that wound up being the case as usual this last Sunday night. In the run-up, though, I had the Sunday morning adult class, and we're in Matthew chapter 18, and my mom gave me a case in point for the discussion material for that night and then to speak concerning this afternoon, where we had a disagreement on the interpretation of what a trespass was in verse 15. If a brother trespasses against you, go to him and deal with it you two alone. One of us thought, and I'm not going to poll, we'll have a poll later about something else, but one of us thought that that trespass was a willful sin, where the brother was intending on sinning against you. The other one suggested that perhaps it was a situation where there could have been a misunderstanding, where they were offended, they felt trespassed against, but it was just a misunderstanding, and in the coming together, it's a gracious thing that nobody else has to be involved. It's like, oh, well, I didn't realize that that's the way I came off. I didn't understand. That isn't really what I said, and this is what I meant whenever I said whatever I said. I think you can probably tell from all the explaining that I was the latter and my mom was the former. And we left Jason Range to clean it up today because neither one of us are there, and I promised the class that Jason would clean it up. But Jason talked to me. We talked afterward, and I made sure that he had the appropriate response this morning whenever he came back. And he did have the appropriate response. And the appropriate response was that there were no losers. There were going to be no losers as it accounted for the disagreement that my mom and I had. Is that there would be a way, and there is a way, there's almost always a way to be able to have a coming together as opposed to there being a winner and a loser. And that's Christ's way. Christ's way is that we're always going to wind up being winners if we demonstrate the love of Christ and we are as we ought to be. I've been asked to address two questions, and I'll address the first one primarily. There will be some, you know, peppering of both probably throughout. But first question, how do you handle disagreements about scriptures when you both make good points? I guess that's kind of a subjective thing. And the second question is the subtle and sometimes unrecognized ways that discord can be sown among brethren. So starting with the first, when we have disagreements in the brotherhood, and before we have disagreements in the brotherhood, we've got to ask ourselves certain questions. We've got to be prepared because disagreements are going to happen. They're going to happen. One thing that we need to ask ourselves is this thing of God? This disagreement, and or the point that I'm trying to make, is this thing of God? And we can hearken back to Jesus' definition of what's good in Luke chapter 18, verse 19. He was called good teacher, and Jesus stopped the man. And he said, why do you call me good? There is one good, and that is God. That is God. we need to pause and we need to approach our doctrine. We need to approach our principles. We need to approach our opinions from the perspective of, is this a thing of God? Is this a thing of God? Paul put it in this way in 1 Corinthians chapter 2. I was certain to know nothing among you except for Christ and Him crucified. He was certain to know nothing. That is imperative. And when we begin to seriously discuss something other than Christ, we need to take pause and we need to make sure of what we're doing, of what we're doing there. I'd like to turn to Luke chapter 9, because there's a serial of disagreements that occur in Luke chapter 9. There's three of them that occur in serial that I'd like to look at here. And the first one is so plain because it says there was a disagreement that arose among the disciples. In Luke chapter 9 and verse 46, an argument started among the disciples as to which one of them would be the greatest. And Jesus, knowing their thoughts, took a little child and had him stand beside him. Then he said to them, "Whoever welcomes this little child in my name welcomes me. And whoever welcomes me welcomes the one who sent me. For he who is least among you all, he is the greatest." One of the questions we've got to ask ourselves is, what is my attitude? What is my attitude? This is not a new teaching that Jesus is offering them. In fact, the psalmist said it very well in Psalm 131. I'm going to read the whole thing too. So buckle up. It's three verses. "My heart is not proud, O Lord, my eyes are not haughty. I do not concern myself with great matters." How many matters do we consider are really, truly great? And how much of it is minutia? Stuff that really doesn't matter. Something that might be of interest or import to us on a personal level, but it doesn't carry the weight or gravity of Christ crucified. "I do not concern myself with great matters or things too wonderful for me, but I have stilled and quieted my soul like a weaned child with its mother. Like a weaned child is my soul within me. O Israel, put your hope in the Lord, both now and forevermore." The psalmist had it right. The psalmist had the right attitude. Whenever we consider ourselves, how seriously do we take ourselves? We got to be careful about taking ourselves too seriously, because then we start taking matters that aren't serious too seriously. And that's a cause for friction. Those are the types of disagreements that we need not really spend a lot of time on. There were a couple others here in Luke chapter 9. Luke chapter 9 and verse 49. "Master," said John, "we saw a man driving out demons in your name, and we tried to stop him because he is not one of us." "Do not stop him," Jesus said, "for whoever is not against you is for you." Now, the question that John and some of the other disciples, "we tried to stop him," was asking is, how do we shut this guy down? How do we shut this down? The question should have been, we don't know this guy. How is he able to work with the power and grace that we're able to work with, being with you? How does that happen, Jesus? That's the question that should have been being asked. But it wasn't, because they're not us. He's not me. We got to be careful about that. We've got to look into these things, and we need to question whether or not these things are of God. In Luke chapter 9, continuing here in the same passage, verse 51. As the time approached for him to be taken up to heaven, Jesus resolutely set out for Jerusalem. And he sent messengers on ahead who went into a Samaritan village to get things ready for him. But the people there did not welcome him because he was heading for Jerusalem. When the disciples James and John saw this, they asked, "Lord, do you want us to call down fire from heaven to destroy them?" But Jesus turned and rebuked them. And some passages also include, "You do not know the spirit of which you are." And they went on to another village. We need to make sure that we don't forget the spirit of which we are. Shall we call down fire from heaven? Shall we destroy them? Jesus is like, "What? Have you not learned anything? That is not what I've been teaching you. Does that sound like anything that I've been teaching you?" It wasn't anything like Jesus was teaching them. But that's how the flesh is, though. We are in the flesh. And the flesh wants to vaunt itself. The flesh wants to change the messaging. Wants to change the messaging and make the disagreement personal. It's me against you. It's us against them. The Spirit says, according to Paul in his writings to 1 Corinthians chapter 6 and verse 7, that we should be willing to suffer an injustice. We should be willing to suffer the injustice. "Oh, that's so unjust. That's so unfair. I'm being treated so poorly." How more Christ-like could you be and suffer an injustice? It's a wonderful lesson that we had this morning from Rick in regards to that's what we've been called to do, is to follow Christ's behavior, Christ's obedience, and suffer injustice from one another. Isn't it better than suffering the justice that we deserve? That's the truth of the matter. All right. Poll question. Because it's Sunday afternoon, it was a good meal, I know. Paul and Barnabas. The topic is John Mark. Who was right? I can stand here an awful long time. I'm good with awkward pauses. Both of them. Anybody else? Barnabas, we got to vote for Barnabas. Somebody willing to make a commitment. Thanks, Dan. We got Paul. We got some "you're wrong" back here. It is apparent in that passage in Acts that the Spirit was silent on this one. That there wasn't great clarity that Paul was right. Or that Barnabas was right. Spirit wanted to see what they'd do with it. Is it possible that they were both right? Is it possible that they were both wrong? If you're going doctrinally, if you're going just with Scripture, and that was inserted in the initial question, disagreements about Scriptures when you're making both good points. You know, Paul had some pretty strong leverage recorded in Luke 9. Later on yet, in Luke 9, Jesus makes the plain statement, "He who looks back after laying his hand to the plow is what? He's not worthy of me." John Mark looked back after he laid his hand to the plow. Don't have any time for him. Gonna have to kick him to the curb. And here's the thing with what Paul was doing. Was it cream puff work that Paul was doing and going to be doing? Paul needed to make sure that he had someone that he could count on. Did he have an uncompassionate heart towards John Mark? Paul had a job to do. And I don't know that Paul had an uncompassionate heart towards John Mark, but he knew that John Mark right now wasn't the guy for the job. Barnabas. What is Barnabas's? It was a nickname that he had. What does Barnabas mean? He was always ready. This young guy, yeah, I know you kind of blew it here. You went home, but I think that we can bring you along. We can bring you along. Is it possible sometimes that when you have a disagreement with a brother or sister that you're both right? Look for those occasions and embrace them. Is it possible that you're both wrong? Probably more times than what we'd like to admit. But we need to embrace that too. Tom Woody. Okay. And then I'll talk about Tom Woody.
My first thought was, we kicked Peter to the curb for denying Christ.
Mm-hmm. They went on. Yeah, well, I might not have, I wouldn't have even followed like Peter did. I don't think. You know, it's easy to stand over a written page sometimes. It's very easy to do that. It's a very different thing to be in relationship and in the relationship on point that Peter had with Jesus. And at the end of the day, it's all about relationships. This passage, Mom, and John's not wearing a tie. And I was going to ask John if he was going to wear a tie or not. Mom's like, oh, wear a tie. So I'm wearing a tie and John's not. But at the end of the day, that passage, you can borrow one if you want it at the end here. This one, Rick's got one that would match. All right, something to think about. At the end of the day, even that passage in Matthew chapter 18, it is about restoring relationships. It's about restored relationships is what this is all about. Whatever the disagreement, if it's a misunderstanding, if it was willful sin, whatever that is, whatever that was, it's about restoration of relationship. And that's what Jesus was all about with Peter. It wasn't proven to Peter that, yeah, you're still carnal, Peter. I think Peter knew that. And Peter had a hard time getting away from that. And we can't because we're in the flesh. We're in the flesh and we can't get away from that. But we can do better in our relationships with one another as long as we maintain the Spirit of Christ when we have disagreement. Amen.
And it's just that there are moments, as you already brought out, that Paul felt like to endure what was ahead of him, he needed somebody different. It didn't mean that he didn't want that help from him anymore, but for what was ahead, that's not. But
yeah.
I think that's why the Spirit never got involved, is because it was a matter of choice not to talk to him.
Yeah. In the end, how did it work out? Spirit was okay with it. Spirit had two teams to work with now instead of just one. So now Paul was able to take along Silas, bring him along, bring him up to speed, bring him up to being an equal in ways. There were crowds that thought that maybe even Silas was the guy, I think, in some of the Acts accounts. And then we have John Mark going with Barnabas, and we see in some of Paul's later writings, John Mark was of great value because of the merciful heart that Barnabas had towards John Mark. So it all worked out in the end, and the Spirit allowed us imperfectly work it out, and he made something productive out of it. He did. Tom Woody and I agreed on a lot of things, but there were times that we disagreed on things. One of the things that we disagreed about was that Tom Woody felt, being in the position and filling the role that he did as an evangelist, he felt as though he had to have a formed opinion on any given question or matter. And with as much study as it took and as much prayer as it took, he almost always, I don't know of the exception because we had the conversation, he didn't like the way I waffled a lot of times. I've got a book at home, and it's painful in the reading. I've tried starting to read it several times, but the pain is in the title. And this is very much me, two Jews, three opinions. And that very much is like me because unlike a lot of you, the more I study, the more questions I have. The more I study, the longer my lessons get. And I keep thinking if I just study well enough, you know, the crystallized thoughts will just come and I'll just be able to lay them down on the page. But the more I look at stuff, the more I know I don't know oftentimes what the definitive answer truly is. But Tom Woody and I got along, even in our disagreements. I enjoyed discussing with him when we disagreed because he always made a good case. He always made a good case. And I knew that I had another opinion to fall back on. Our humility needs to be exercised perhaps more than it is. And it's not a false humility that I'm talking about. And we can see this demonstrated in John chapter 9. And the entire John 9 account is the man who was born blind. And we see the Pharisees, you know, indulging this man as things kind of go along, and the teachers of the law indulge this man. And they're like, well, so what happened? What happened? And so the man told them what happened, how Jesus had healed his eyes. And they go to his parents because they got to search this out. His parents say, well, he's of age, you ask him. So they come back to him a second time. And in verse 24, they summon him and say, give glory to God. We know this man is a sinner. So they've already got their agenda set up. Be careful of our agendas. Be careful of what we already know to be the case. And the fact of the matter is that we know earlier in John chapter 3, Nicodemus, this is a bold-faced lie, because Nicodemus testified to Jesus himself, we all know you're from God. We all know you're from God. But they were letting their agenda get in the way. He replied, whether he is a sinner or not, I don't know. But one thing I do know, I was blind, but now I see. And they coddle him again with this false, oh, they're going to try and find out what's going on here. Then they asked him, what did he do to you? How did he open your eyes? And this is when it goes from bad to worse for this man. I have already told you, and you did not listen. So he's already shared the truth. The truth has been shared already. Why do you want to hear it again? Do you want to become his disciples too? Then they hurled insults at him and said, you are this fellow's disciple. We are disciples of Moses. We know that God spoke to Moses, but as for this fellow, we don't even know where he comes from. And the man answered, now that is remarkable. You don't know where he comes from, yet he opened my eyes. We know that God does not listen to sinners. He listens to the godly man who does his will. Nobody's ever heard of opening the eyes of a man born blind. And if this man were not from God, he could do nothing. And to this they replied, you were steeped in sin at birth. How dare you lecture us? And they threw him out. The flesh wants us to throw each other out when we have a disagreement. The flesh wants us to be right. And it's not about us being right. It's not about me or you being right or wrong. It's about who's on God's side. And is this truly a thing of God? Who was wrong in that instance in John chapter 9? It's the ones who would not be told and who could not be told. May that not be us. I'd like to move on ever so briefly here in regards to the subtle and sometimes unrecognized ways that discord can be sown among the brethren. One way, and Jay talked about this just a little bit yesterday. You remember when? You know, the good old days. The preacher wrote in Ecclesiastes chapter 7 and verse 10, don't ask, why were the former days better than these? It is not from wisdom that you ask this. And even some of our own poets have written, the good old days weren't always good, and tomorrow ain't as bad as it seems. That's one way, and that's a way that generationally we can kind of get in each other's way. We must realize that we're predisposed from our upbringings, too. In Hebrews chapter 12, it's telling what the Hebrew writer here says and the way he says it. In Hebrews chapter 12 and verse 9, he says, moreover, we have all had human fathers who disciplined us and respected them for it. How much more should we submit to the Father of our spirits and live? Our fathers disciplined us for a little while as they thought best. But God disciplines us for our good. Implied there is that our physical parents didn't always get it right for whatever reason. And there are a lot of reasons why we as parents don't get it right. Some of them are even good. Some of them aren't. Sometimes we're disciplined wrong, and sometimes we're discipled wrong in our walks. And we need to admit that. You know, we're not perfect. Those who have instructed us through the years, they weren't perfect. And sometimes we'll say a thing and then we'll do another thing. Sometimes we might be hospitable, but then we might turn around and gossip about what we found out when we were being hospitable. Sometimes we may help someone who's weaker, but then we'll judge them in their weakness. And this is being imperfectly discipled. There is plenty to fix about every one of us, but don't be looking down at your neighbor, your brother, or sister, wondering why they aren't fixed yet. Can you imagine if Jesus had done that? Jesus had looked around at everybody and it's like, oh, y'all just need fixed. You so broke. You so broke, and you won't let me work on you. You won't let the Spirit of God do His thing. The closest he got was, oh, ye of little faith. Well, there's your answer. Faith. Faith in Jesus. Doing what he does. Allowing him to work in your life. When dealing with differences, remember that you might not know what's going on with the other person. And again, being genuine and authentic with one another will improve that in our relationships. Building and strengthening, restoring relationships one with the other. Mary and Martha were tending Lazarus, and they ultimately lost him. You think that there were some people who weren't close friends that encountered them, might not have known what was going on with them? Peter's mother-in-law was sick. Who knows? Maybe they were close. Maybe Peter was stressed over that was going on. Paul had the weight and concern of the churches on him night and day. I can't imagine the opportunities that Paul had to be cross. No, we don't know what's going on with our brother or sister, and that may be kind of coloring the picture for them a little bit. I appreciate Jay leading 207 today. Lily of the Valley. Sometimes things can slip in subtly, and sometimes they're insignificant. They may not always be recognized. Lily of the Valley, another song in the Red Book, Rose of Sharon, both reference Jesus as the Lily of the Valley. Where do we find those references? It's in a writing of Solomon. It's a song that he wrote. It's in the Song of Solomon. And in years past, in the old King James Version, when all you had was the King James Version text and you didn't have much reason to even investigate, oftentimes, you know, the versions will come out and there'll be study materials embedded all around the scriptures. The individual that's being referenced as the lily of the valley and the rose of Sharon is actually the bride in the Song of Solomon. Song of Solomon chapter 2 and verse 1 is where those both, and I don't find it happen again any other place in scripture. We've been getting it wrong potentially. Should we stop singing 207? Well, I asked Jay to lead it today. Is it going to be an impediment to my faith? There are some other songs that we sing that it may just be from a different perspective that we have. I'll give you an example. And my father and I disagree on this one. The 77 in the Blue Book. Have you seen Jesus my Lord? Depending on your perspective, one might look at that and say, if I sing this, when I sing this, I'm making Jesus some sort of a naturalistic force. And it's nature or a naturalistic force that I'm saying is my Savior, per se. But I can tell you, I've had some heated conversations with some Catholics who believe that there was no Jesus before the Immaculate Conception. And to acknowledge the fact that Jesus Christ was instrumental and was the capital C creator of the world is very meaningful to me. But we have these different perspectives, these different experiences that will color or change the way that we approach and we view things that we collectively, congregationally handle in our worship and otherwise. How should we handle that? I wait for him to leave. Then we might lead 77. It's been a long time since I've led that song, by the way, because I'm sensitive to that. I'm sensitive to that. And we should be sensitive towards one another. It was an added bonus for me. There is a habitation, 445, where there's a reference to within its pearly portals, angelic armies sing. And came from my dad, from Kenny Long, and I'm not sure where he got it from otherwise. But, and I took it up as a challenge. There's never a record of angels singing in the scriptures. That's some homework for you. There are a lot of sayings. There is worship, but there's no express singing. And you can get my email at the conclusion of my lesson. If you'd like to send me, you can call me. You can complain to the elders. It's one of those things where there are things that are subtle. And are these things that are going to hang our faith? I sure hope not. But if there is a weaker brother or sister, because we're all weaker at times and stronger at times, that's me, is that we need to make sure that we're caring for one another in the way that Jesus would have us. In closing, Jesus in John chapter 13, verse 35. Jesus said, "This is how men will know that you're my disciples." And he didn't finish that statement with, "because you'll blow them away with your wisdom," which they would. He didn't finish it that you'll amaze them with impossible miracles, which they did. He did not say that you'll impress them by how firmly you will stand in the face of persecution. What he said was, "This is how men will know you're my disciples, that you love one another." And you know, when we reference Matthew as the tax collector and Simon the Zealot, where they were politically, culturally, within the Jewish community, they were at complete odds. And Simon the Zealot obviously hated any agent of the Roman government as a zealot would. But this isn't a static theological truism. This is an actionable expectation that Jesus has for you and I. You know what? I think that sometimes, perhaps even most times, dare I say, Jesus, the Father, and Spirit are more interested not in our differences, but how we treat one another in our differences. When we have disagreements, we need to make sure of several things. To ask ourselves, is this thing of God? Or are we elevating a matter to the level of Christ crucified? We need to make sure that we forget not the spirit of which we are. We need to remember that each of us experiences brokenness in ourselves and in our lives and in our relationships. And Jesus died to heal all of that. In Galatians, Paul talks about, you know, breaking down the wall, not only between God and man, but between men as well. And when we have disagreements, we need to make sure that our brother and sister, we remember that they are the one for whom Christ died.